From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. A generation ago, the Walt Disney Studios made some of the greatest animated movies ever. Films like Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, and 101 Dalmatians. Now there's a new generation of Disney animators continuing in that tradition. We talked to one of them today on this edition of Fresh Air, Glenn Keane, the man who drew the Beast in the new movie, Beauty and the Beast. Also, we meet producer Norman Lear. He changed the look of TV with shows like All in the Family and Mary Hartman. He'll talk about defending free speech both on and off the television. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about some classic blues recordings by the great Bessie Smith. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. government has officially invited Middle East negotiators to come to Washington, D.C. on December 4th for the next round of bilateral talks between Israel and Syria, Israel and Lebanon, and Israel and a joint Palestinian-Jordanian delegation. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Arab and Israeli negotiators have been unable to agree on a location for the next round of bilateral talks, which formally began in Madrid after the Middle East peace conference 3 weeks ago. Israel would like the talks to take place in or near the Middle East because this might imply, to some, Arab recognition of Israel's right to exist. Key Arab leaders balked at the idea. In the absence of agreement on this matter, the U.S. government took the initiative and issued the invitations to Washington. Most analysts expect that negotiators from both sides will come to Washington because no one wants to be accused of derailing the talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
So far, only Jordan has accepted the U.S. invitation. A delegation of Haitian lawmakers has arrived in Cartagena, Colombia, for talks with deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Members of the delegation suggested that they had agreed to the talks because of the suffering caused by an embargo imposed on Haiti by the Organization of American States. The president of Haiti's Senate said that the embargo was unjust and that people were dying because transportation is not available to take them to doctors. The head of the OAS group that's sponsoring the meeting said that his objective was to return President Aristide to office within a constitutional framework. House Democrats passed out veto pens today in a publicity effort to suggest that President Bush has no domestic agenda. The White House has successfully vetoed 24 bills since he took office, and Democrats say it's become a battle between the president and the American people. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Although President Bush does not yet hold the record for the most successful vetoes of any administration, congressional Democrats are more than frustrated with their inability to override. Today they launched a campaign to use the president's string of vetoes against him. Majority Leader Richard Gephardt says the president's entire domestic agenda can be summed up by the veto pen.
He's used it to thwart the will of the American people, to defend the status quo of a declining economy, to preserve the privileges of the powerful, and to deny the positive role of government as an agent of renewal and change.
But when it comes to economic recovery, the Democrats say they don't want to force another veto. They're holding back on an economic growth package, they say, until the president comes out with a plan of his own. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 2,902.73. Declines led advances by more than 2-1. This is NPR News. Kurdish guerrillas claim to have defeated Iraqi troops in a fresh round of fighting in northern Iraq. A rebel spokesman in London said that the Peshmerga guerrillas repulsed an Iraqi attack near Erbil, the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. The claim could not be independently verified. Talks between the Kurds and the government of Saddam Hussein have been stalled for months. The Peshmergas claim to control several northern towns, but say that Saddam has ordered a new Iraqi troop buildup. Superior Court judges in Phoenix have dismissed charges against four men who had been accused of killing nine people at a Buddhist temple last summer. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports.
The arrest of the four Tucson men was heralded as a major breakthrough in the Buddhist temple murders. Sheriff's investigators had obtained confessions from the men, but the case fell apart last month when two Phoenix-area teenagers also confessed, and police found the murder weapons in their possession. Francisco Ulloa is a nephew of one of the men being released.
We're just glad it's over. We're just that our prayers have been answered. That's all we can say.
The Tucson defendants are being released without prejudice, meaning charges can be refiled if authorities find new evidence in the case. They've been held in a Phoenix jail for the past 2 months. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
A major grain conglomerate warned today that worldwide stocks of grain are at their lowest level since the mid-1970s. The Minneapolis-based Cargill Incorporated said that a crop failure in any major producing country could trigger an international food crisis. Cargill said that the world has only enough grain on hand to last for 63 days. Those inventories have fallen from a high point of 109 days worth in the winter of 1986 and 87. Analysts have predicted that world grain production in the coming year will be down 5% from last season. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Beauty and the Beast, the newest Disney animated feature, opens today, and the advance word is that it's going to be a hit. Newsweek said it already has the feel of a classic. When you go, expect an updated beauty with an independent streak and lavish musical numbers with original songs. My guest today is the head animator for the character of the Beast, Glenn Keane. Keane started at Disney Studios in 1974, learning from some of Uncle Walt's old-time animators who used to hold training classes at night. While at Disney, Keane has drawn the bear fight in The Fox and the Hound and supervised the animation for Ariel in The Little Mermaid. When I spoke to Keane today from New York, I asked him if he had to audition for the right to draw the Beast in Beauty and the Beast.
Well, no, I didn't really have to audition because we have a... It's like a theater group of animators there that has gone from one picture to the next picture to the next picture. And so they all know my work, and it's more of like casting the different artists in different parts. In the past, I've done, I get cast doing the big, powerful characters usually. There was a big bear I animated, a giant, and recently in Rescuers Down Under, it was a big eagle. But I'd also was the directing animator on Ariel, Little Mermaid. And so that was a big change for me. So they felt like, well, Glenn can do the big, powerful characters, but also sensitive. And that's really what Beast has to be.
Well, I must say, looking at the Beast, he appears to be really a concoction of animals.
Well, yeah, you're right, Marty. He's a combination of about, I don't know, 8 different creatures. See, when we first started the picture in London, I would have to walk to work each day, and I'd walk through the London Zoo and past this big cage of wolves. So it's the back legs of Beast are wolf legs. Then his there was a mandrill there in the zoo named Boris, and Boris and I got to know each other well because I'd go there each day and sketch him a lot, and he has kind of an exotic primate look. So Beast has a bit of a primate look in him. Then the we needed like the cuddle factor because somewhere in there you knew Beauty was going to have to put her arms around this guy and feel like, gee, I could love this character. You know, he couldn't look like alien, you know, as in terms of ugliness. There had to be potential. So I put the mane of a lion on him. Probably the most inspiring animal, though, to me was a buffalo.
Uh-huh.
There's just a sadness and a heaviness that a buffalo has. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I had a buffalo head on my wall at work from a taxidermy place down the street. That is a constant reminder of the size and presence of that this was an animal and a big creature.
How much research did you do trying to understand his psyche? And it's clear, I think, from the way you're talking that you really spent a fair amount of time, I guess, doing a psychological study of who Beast is, and I assume even looking back into the old stories of Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, every film that I work on, I usually write a whole I don't know, character study on him. How I feel, his expressions, what he wants, how he feels about himself. Because as real as he is to me, that's how real he's going to become to the audience. If it's just a drawing, the audience finds him empty. But if the animator really just gets into that character, suddenly it becomes more than just moving characters on the screen. Like when I started at Disney, I started in 74 with the old guys that had done Pinocchio and Snow White, and they kept giving me this advice, and I didn't understand what they were saying, but they would kept saying, Glenn, your work has got to be sincere. You know, make sure that the animation is sincere. And I thought, how do you draw sincere? And it came to me on one scene. It was one of the first scenes I animated, and it was just a very simple little scene of Bernard in The First Rescuers. He's sweeping, and I was struggling with this action of how do you draw this little mouse sweep? And I went to Eric Larson, one of Walt's, what he called his nine old men, the key leaders in animation, and said, well, Eric, can you help me with this? And I expected him to do some drawing for me, and he said, well, Glenn, what kind of a job do you think Bernard wants to do? I said, what do you mean? I mean, he wants to do a good job, don't you think? I said, well, yeah, I guess he does. I'm like, come on, just show me how to draw him. And he says, well, of course he wants to do a good job. He wants every speck of dust off that floor. He really cares about it, doesn't he? I said, yeah, he does. Yeah, he's going to put his whole shoulder, his heart into this. He's going to make sure every speck of dust is off that floor, you know. And I left that room knowing exactly how to animate that without him doing one drawing. It was just that he really told me, you got to know that character. You have to feel the way that character feels before you can really animate it. And then it just rolled out of my fingers very easily. And from that, I think that's the baton that the old guys have passed on to this new generation of animators, is that whatever you animate, make sure that you're personally convicted and you believe in what it is that you're drawing.
Do you work with a mirror at all, using even your own face, your own eyes?
Yeah. Everything that the character is doing there, I'm sort of doing on my own face. We tend to draw ourselves into the characters. Even if, you know, like I was doing Ariel, the directors would say, Glenn, that's you. That looks just like you. I said, oh, man, come on. I hope I'm not drawing her like me. It's no, it's in a good way. I mean, I can see your expressions in her, translated.
But this is an unconscious process you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, you don't try to do it that way. It's just naturally. You draw because you're looking at your face. You're feeling, like I'll do mouth movements and I'll feel, let's see, how much of my canines are showing here? And I'll draw it out. I'll look at it in the mirror. It's really just trying to draw how I feel and what expressions I feel on my face and put it into the acting.
I'm speaking with Glenn Keane, and he's a supervising animator who designed and drew the Beast in Disney's latest movie, Beauty and the Beast. Where do you start in the drawing process? Do you have voices? Where do the voices come in?
Well, I mean, that's a very key part there. You don't really know the character until you've got the actor who's doing the voice. I can only get a design up to a certain level, but then the character is going to change that. In this case, designed the Beast, and then we were still searching for a voice. We had voices like Tim Curry, who'd done The Devil and Legend, more of a deep baritone, and it didn't seem like there was a young man inside of this beast. We somehow had to get a sensitive, gentle side to him and yet still have a beast side. So we started listening to a whole bunch of different tapes. The directors, Kirk and Gary, gave to me a tape with 12 different voices that they'd boiled it down to. And they said, well, Glenn, listen to these and see which ones you think. And they were going to listen to it as well that weekend. And I remember doing dishes at home and just listening to each of the voices. I didn't know who was who, and waiting for one of them to trigger the design that I had already drawn, trigger it acting and moving around in my head. And as soon as this one voice popped on, Beast was alive. He was moving. I could see the expressions acting and just coming out of the Beast. And so I stopped and looked back, and it was Robbie Benson.
And I think that would surprise a lot of the audience.
Well, it surprised me, too, because I think your perception of Robbie is not to do this big, beastly character. But that's a real mistake, and from any artist's viewpoint, to pigeonhole somebody into what they can't do. I think often if you ask somebody to do what's out of their norm, you're going to get the best performance of that person's life. And I feel like that happened with Robbie Benson.
What are the tools of your trade? Is it as simple as paper and pencil?
Well, basically it is. All the modern technologies and things that have been invented with computers and all of that, that has not changed a painter's approach or a musician's approach. He still has to work note by note if he's writing a song, or as an artist, he still has to do 24 drawings for every second that you see on the screen. That's in terms of acting, you've got to be able to have a drawing that's going to express an emotion and a character, and then a series of them that shows how that character is going to move from one expression into the next. You're seeing changes. But the way I look at it is it's not tedious. Mm. I think that's the thing most people wonder is, well, don't they have computers that do that stuff for you guys now? I mean, you're like living in Stone Ages. And it's like, well, no, I don't look at it that way at all. It's like, you know, does a musician think of a song that he's writing note by note? I said, no, he thinks of a melody. And as an animator, I don't think of it drawing by drawing. It's a performance. It's a whole action and an emotion that I'm portraying. And I'll rough through that scene really fast. See, my drawings, if you saw them, they're more like gesture sketches, very quick, maybe some of them just done in 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds. And I'll rough through a whole acting performance there. And then once I get all of that out onto the page, and I'll shoot it to see how it acts, play it with the voice, because we have the voice recorded first, then I do my acting based on what I hear. Then when it's right, I'll go in and I'll tie it down and do the more finished drawing, which you would expect to see from a Disney animator.
Knowing that kids will bring their parents with them to see Disney movies, do you make visual references to the adults in the audience?
The pictures that we make, we don't make them for kids necessarily. We really make them for ourselves. And since we're a bunch of adults, that's the natural part. Then we do add in stuff for the kids. I mean, it's more the other way around,
right.
Especially this story, which is such an emotional and there's such a deep underlying themes about what is love, how do we view beauty in life, and these are some really important topics and very adult themes.
So the kids are an afterthought?
Well, kind of, in a way. You know, we put a lot of the jokes and gags in there. The heart is really where you start with, and that's going to be more appealing to the adults in a lot of ways. Though the kids love it, but they don't particularly know why at that point.
I'm speaking with Glenn Keane, and he's the supervising animator. He designed and drew The Beast in Beauty and the Beast. He's been with Disney Studios for 16 years, and he has worked on other Disney classics, including The Bear Fight in The Fox and the Hound, Professor Radigan in The Great Mouse Detective, Ariel in The Little Mermaid, and Marahout in The Rescuers Down Under. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with animator Glenn Keane. What cartoons did you enjoy watching when you were a kid?
Well, the first one I remember was a Popeye cartoon with Sinbad. And there was this huge bird that took off and took olive oil to this island, and Popeye went to rescue her. And it was just so real to me, where Popeye's going into this cave and there's these lions, and it was just...
Are you describing an epiphany?
I couldn't believe it, that this wasn't a cartoon to me. Well, I had no idea that anybody drew this stuff. As a kid, I didn't think that way. It was just real. I guess I still look at it that way as I'm animating. I'm not drawing it. It's just really happening. I just happen to have my fingers in the right place at the right time. then the next picture that I really remember having an impact on me was, that must have been the Popeye one. I had to be 4 or 5 years old. The next one was 101 Dalmatians when I was about 6. I went to see it with my family. They took me to that on my birthday. And once again, that film was so real. I mean, if you think about it, it's probably true to most listeners is that the films that they remember as the most real, having the most impact on them, were not the live-action pictures. They were the animated features, because it has nothing to do with that it's just a pretend drawing or something. That Cruella was a witch. I was frightened of her. You know, I was just really afraid of that woman, that she was going to do something to our family dog. And I feel like I've brought that same attitude back into the work that we do now, that we look at it as very real. This isn't just pretend. I would love to see the Academy actually start looking at animation that way.
You were a cartoon character yourself. You were Billy in your father's cartoon strip, The Family Circus.
Yeah. Dad based the Family Circus on his own real family. So, like, if we did goofy stuff around at home, he'd try to draw that into the comic strip, you know. Of course, it was never really odd. You didn't, you know, Dad wouldn't say, look, kids, I'm really low on gags. Will you do something funny today? I didn't even think it was unusual. I just thought every kid's dad was an artist, until one day at grade school, some kid came up to me and said, you think you're so big because your dad draws a family circus. I thought, gee, I thought he drew the better half. I didn't even realize that he drew the family circus. To me, it was just normal. Everybody's dad drew. Dad worked at home in the studio attached to the house, so anytime I needed to get help with drawings, I'd go out there, and he'd go over my work with me, and it was great having a live-in teacher.
And that was what he was for you? I mean, he taught you how to draw?
Yeah. Yeah, he... one of the best things I think Dad did for me is he gave me a book called Dynamic Anatomy by Bern Hogarth. In fourth grade, I had that book, and I immediately started thinking of my art not in terms of drawing cartoons, which I really appreciate my dad's influence that way, that he started making me look at figure and learning the bone structure and the skeleton and muscles. And I remember going in the bus to school with some drawings I had done of the thinker and the discus thrower and all the muscles and on these figures. Of course, the guys had no clothes on, though. And I remember sitting on the bus. I was really proud of these drawings, and I was going to take them to fourth grade. And other kids in the class were looking at these drawings I had done, and they were making fun of them. Look at Keane's drawing naked guys! Ah! I thought, what's wrong with this? I didn't realize there was a problem with it until everybody started making fun of me for doing that. I realized, I guess, at that time that there was a difference in the what I saw was really important to what I wanted to do, and most of the other kids, and they didn't really see drawing as the way I saw it. Drawing to them was just fun and cartoons. I really was taking it pretty seriously, I think.
Do you watch Saturday morning cartoons with your kids?
The only time I watch it is just to see what it is that's going into their heads. You know, I really don't watch it much because they're under such different limitations than we are. They have to produce so much more work, so much faster, that it's almost a whole different medium than what we do in the animated features. And it's easy to be critical of it from my standpoint, but I don't think it's very fair to be too critical, because put in the same position, I'm not sure how I could do it. Actually, I don't think that I would be in animation if I had to work on Saturday morning. I would go into painting or sculpture or something else that I could really express myself in.
Is that because of the limitation of the emotions? From my observations, it seems that Saturday morning cartoons are either kind of cold and stylized and sort of emotionless, or it's the syrupy, cuddly, sentimental emotions.
Well, the animators aren't given the time to really pour themselves into those characters, and much of the animation is done overseas in Japan, and often it's based on some American animators drawing some poses, sending it to Japan, and those Japanese animators kind of filling in, making it move. So it really takes ownership away from any individual person really expressing themselves. It's such a factory approach that it's you don't get that passion, I think, that you sense in watching Beauty and the Beast, that there's a bunch of artists who really poured themselves into this. Not that people don't put everything they've got into it. It's just the time frame that it happens. It's so fast. You don't really have a chance to express yourself.
Do you watch The Simpsons at all?
Yeah, I do. I've seen that. Well, my kids really love to watch it. I think the writing is fantastic on it.
And the drawing?
The drawing, well, to be honest, it bugs me because for everything that I put into my work is trying to analyze what I see in real life and trying to translate that into my drawing. I mean, it may be the way a little girl will sit in a chair with her feet kind of curled up underneath her and kind of her feet playing with their shoes, and that's interesting to me, or the way their subtle hand gestures, all those things, that's what I try to put into my work, and The Simpsons aren't approaching it that way. So I see it as something very different than what I'm working on. So I can't criticize the drawing from it because they're not trying to do what I'm doing. But it's, I don't know. I guess it's an area that I'm trying to broaden my horizons and leave room for other people, because certainly I enjoy it and I can't deny that.
Do you doodle a lot? I mean, are you always kind of sketching and
yeah,
pen or pencil in hand?
Yeah, I've got my pen and pad right here.
Yeah, what are you doing?
I'm doing a drawing of you. You happen to look like... No, I'm trying to, everywhere I go, bring my sketch pad with me and draw everybody I see or places I go, just because it's a... I want that kind of avenue to keep open. I don't want it to kind of close up where, from what I see in the world around me, starts. I want it to be able to come through my fingers. And the wider I can make those channels, the better animation I feel I'm going to be able to do. Every time I go out to dinner with my wife, I've got my sketch pad and I've got a lot of drawings of her eating.
Is that kind of staying in shape in between projects?
Yeah, I guess it is. You know, I don't look at drawing as, it is a discipline, but it's a love. And you'd think after drawing, you know, all day long, that's the last thing I'd want to do. But that's not the case. I would love to get a chance to do other kinds of drawing and painting and sculpture on the side. I think that a frustration any artist has is that you're not going to have enough time in this life to express all the things that you see and feel about, you know, what God has made. And you want a chance to do that and to say something back to the world.
Do you know what your next project is going to be?
Yeah, I'm right now working on Aladdin. In this picture, I'm doing the character of Aladdin. And I guess the same challenges that I had with Ariel, where you want to do a princess that kind of breaks the mold a little bit, I want to do that with Aladdin and break the mold of the prince.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Animator Glenn Keane. He supervised the animation for The Beast in the new Disney film, Beauty and the Beast. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with producer Norman Lear about the group he founded, People for the American Way, and their efforts to fight the gag rule, prohibiting doctors in federally funded clinics from discussing abortion with their clients. President Bush just vetoed legislation by Congress which would have repealed it. Lear will also tell us about the family behind All in the Family and about his new sitcom due out this January. Also, the great blues singer Bessie Smith sang with a number of legendary horn players, Louis Armstrong, for instance. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us one of her best musical partnerships may be the least well-known. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. officials have proposed that the next round of Middle Eastern peace talks be held in Washington December 4th. A State Department spokeswoman said today that after waiting 3 weeks for the parties directly involved to agree on a site for the next round of bilateral talks, U.S. officials decided to propose the meeting be held in Washington. So far, the only delegation to accept the invitation has been Jordan. Israel had wanted the talks to be held in the Middle East, while the Arab states wanted the talks held in Europe. In Yugoslavia, heavy artillery fire has been reported in one of the last remaining strongholds in the eastern part of Croatia. Kathy Jenkins filed this report for the BBC.
The shelling of Osijek has now been going on for nearly 2 days, with the local population in air raid shelters. Croatian radio says the firing is coming from Serbian irregulars and Federal Army positions in villages to the south and east of the town. Osijek, which has suffered heavily since the outbreak of hostilities, is considered by Croatia to be a major target for the Serbian-dominated army now that Vukovar has fallen. However, Osijek is not the only target of fresh bombardments. The Adriatic port of Zadar is also reported to have come under attack. European community monitors are trying to gain permission from the army to enter two villages near the port, which are now behind army lines. The monitors are also trying to negotiate a safe passage for more than 100 federal troops stranded near Zadar after one of the main bridges on the Adriatic Highway was blown up.
Kathy Jenkins reporting for the BBC. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held hearings on allegations that the Reagan-Bush campaign conspired with Iran to delay the release of 52 American hostages until after Election Day 1980, this in an effort to hurt President Jimmy Carter's chances for re-election. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Former Carter administration official Gary Sick, who has written about the so-called October surprise allegations, told a Senate subcommittee today that Cyrus Hashemi, a businessman who was a go-between with Iran for both Presidents Carter and Reagan, was under FBI surveillance in October of 1980. That's when meetings allegedly took place between Reagan-Bush campaign officials and the Iranians to discuss a delay in the hostage release. Hashemi is dead, but if the FBI records could be obtained, Sick said, they might help determine whether or not those meetings took place. The Senate has yet to move to a full investigation of the allegations. Republicans have been threatening to filibuster a resolution authorizing the Senate to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on the probe. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials fell nearly 30 points to close at 2,902.73 on volume of some 188 million shares. This is NPR News. Congress has given final approval to a $291 billion military budget that contains spending ceilings for military programs, along with forced cutbacks of some 106,000 people. Both the House and Senate approved the bill by wide margins, and the president is expected to sign it. Congress turned down a White House request for authority to buy 4 more B-2 bombers, saying it was not clear that they are needed in the wake of the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union. But at the same time, close to $2 billion is allocated to buy bomber components in the event a vote is taken next year to resume production. The world's cleanest gasoline has been mandated for use in California starting in 1996. This new gasoline will have far less of the types of hydrocarbons that are most responsible for urban smog. From Los Angeles, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The new gasoline is expected to produce 30% to 40% less smog than today's grades. The cancer risks from compounds such as benzene also will be substantially reduced. The cost of the gasoline, however, will be higher. The State Air Resources Board, which regulates auto emissions, estimates the cost to be at least 10 cents more per gallon. The new regulations for the clean air recipe were adopted by the Air Resources Board today. The 1996 standards follow on the heels of interim standards that become effective in California on January 1st. California, which has the nation's worst air quality, has led the nation in setting the strictest tailpipe emission standards for cars and trucks, as well as the strictest requirements for the fuels that power them. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against most major foreign currencies. Gold prices were up. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. An article in American Film Magazine says, if television is bolder, freer, more topical, closer to life, it's because Norman Lear was there first. In 1971, when Lear's sitcom All in the Family hit the screens, new, daring topics began to appear on TV. Bigotry, sexism, menopause, and impotence were all discussed by the Bunkers. The success of All in the Family led to the spin-offs Maude, The Jeffersons, and Good Times. Then Lear turned the soap opera on its head with Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. In the mid-70s, he and his associates had up to 7 hit sitcoms on the air at the same time. In 1978, he walked away from prime time. This past summer, he ended his 13-year absence with Sunday Dinner. Though the show didn't catch on, Lear will be back early next year with a black satire called The Powers That Be. During his years away from creating TV shows, Norman Lear turned towards politics and in 1980 founded People for the American Way, a citizens group dedicated to stemming the growing political influence of the religious right. One of their current campaigns is fighting the new gag rule, which prohibits doctors at federally funded family planning clinics from counseling patients about abortion. And Lear is again using television to get his message across.
We had a spot running. A woman, a major in the United States Air Force, served in the Gulf War, and came back and did a 60-second television spot for People for the American Way, in which, standing in front of a portrait of her family, 4 children, 4 grown children, and she said, look, I left my husband and my 4 children to go to fight in the Gulf War because my country needed me there, and there I am fighting for somebody else's freedom while I'm away. What happens? I come back to find my own freedoms have been seriously eroded, because I no longer have the opportunity to discuss all my options with my doctor in any federally funded place, which would suggest the very base in which she serves, because she's at an air base.
You wrote that spot.
I did. Yes, I did. As a father of 3 grown daughters, I guess I'd feel the same way. I wouldn't have to be the father with 3 grown daughters, but it certainly sensitizes. I just can't, imagine why we need all of those, we need a lot of stuffy, older, white males interfering with women's choices and their bodies and their relationships with their physicians.
What has been the reaction to that spot?
The best reaction we had was from the White House.
Oh, yeah?
They called and said, please cease and desist, take it off. And then there was some suggestion that a presidential memo was going to straighten it out and perhaps we wouldn't need to have it on. And there was a memo, some kind of doublespeak, which really changed nothing, but fooled some, I guess.
Would you say that your opponent is the American Family Association, headed by Reverend Donald Wildman? Do you see them as your opposing team?
No. No, I see a general drift in the entire culture that the Donald Wildmans can take advantage of. That is really the enemy. I see over 30, 40 years a drift in our country to numbers, to only that which can be quantified. We have drifted so far from what can't be quantified to become a nation that only celebrates what can be. I think that's what the wild winds feed on us, a spiritual, not malaise, an emptiness in the country that they feed on.
Well, most recently, the American Family Association campaigned against, I believe it was potential advertisers for a sitcom of yours that aired this past summer called Sunday Dinner. Mm-hmm. What did they find so offensive?
They hadn't seen the show. They heard that somebody in the show was going to discuss God. They knew that they're the only people who can do that because they've got a lock on it and know exactly what it is. I mean, so they my understanding is they simply did not wish it to be touched, the subject. So long before it was out, they were condemning it.
Do you think if they had seen it, they would find something offensive about it? For instance, the woman in the sitcom or in Sunday Dinner has what some could describe as a kind of casual relationship with God, calls him or her chief.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that you think that they would find offensive?
I think they would have found that offensive. The handful that did see it, not related to Wildman particularly, took some umbrage at that, despite the fact that I guess even in the Bible era, there are a couple of dozen references that different ways biblical characters have spoken of the deity.
My guest is Norman Lear. He's a television producer, of course, producer of many successful television shows, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, Fernwood Tonight, Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. Back in 1980, he founded People for the American Way, a citizens group concerned with protecting the First Amendment. We'll talk some more. First, we'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Producer Norman Lear is my guest. I want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about your career in television. How autobiographical would you say your TV shows are?
Well, I think most writers write out of, they all write out of themselves. Some use their heads and their imaginations more, some use their experience. I write much more out of my experience, so everything is autobiographical for me to some extent.
Let's say something like All in the Family. How much was that a show about you and your father?
It was a great deal about me and my father and other relatives. He was not Archie Bunker, but he was intolerant in his own fashion. I was always the laziest white kid he ever met. And I would scream at him, wondering how he could put down a race of people to call me lazy. Because I didn't understand it, then I became also the dumbest white kid he ever met. So there was never any convincing him.
And was it true that your father used to say to your mother, stifle it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And he was always wishing to work for himself, to be in business for himself. And that was a big facet in Archie, too. And he'd always have another scheme or another idea or some way to... I didn't do this with Archie, but my father was somebody who was had to have $1 million, was going to have $1 million in 10 days to 2 weeks.
Did he ever see the show?
No. He died before All in the Family.
Do you wish he had seen the show?
Oh, I wish he had seen the show, yes. I think about that often. My mother saw the show. She didn't remember at all that my father used to say, stifle yourself, Jeanette.
What did you think when you saw things like Archie Bunker for President... bumper stickers?
I don't even remember those. I remember coffee mugs. I don't remember. Did they seriously, somebody wish to run Archie Bunker for president?
Well, I used to see those, and I always wondered whether people driving those cars got it, you know, whether they got what the show was about.
I think had he not been a fictional character, and had he made it, things might be about the same.
You had a wonderfully original mix of comedy and social commentary. Were you really using the comedy to try to get the audience to address or confront some social issues?
Oh, you know, which comes first, yeah. The chicken or the egg? I don't think so. I think everything derives of whether one is, how one is, you know, inner directed or minded. Or I'm basically a serious person. I love comedy. It's the way I see life. You know, the foolishness of the human condition is something that fascinates me. I see it. I don't care what the situation is. And but it doesn't make me a less serious person. It's also been clear to me from a lifetime as a member of a theater audience somewhere that I laugh hardest when I'm caring, and vice versa. If I'm already emotionally involved in laughter and you want me to cry, I'm more available. So I love those dynamics, and I love laughter and tears side by side. So just as somebody, you know, if comedy were a field like medicine, I would take the laughter and tears department as opposed to the farce. So, you know, I would grow up in my specialty.
How much were you influenced by live theater? So much of your work takes place indoors. You use a live audience a lot.
Yeah, totally. I love, that's what I love about tape, because it is, we do everything in front of a live audience, and we don't try to fool, well, you can't fool a machine, you just press a button, and it does what it does for you. But you can't do that with a couple hundred live people. They either laugh or they don't.
I think one of your gifts was really finding new faces, people on TV that we wouldn't normally associate, people like Jimmy Walker and Louise Lasser, even mm-hmm. Carol O'Connor. When you were looking for someone All in the Family or Sanford and Son or Maude or any of those shows, were you looking for a specific kind of face?
No, usually in the early years, I'd spent a lot of years seeing everything that existed on Broadway, off Broadway, and so I had a reservoir of faces and talents and memories of moments in little theaters everywhere. And when things started going well for me in California, I remembered Rue McClanahan from this place and Conrad Bain from another, and so many of those people were all people I'd seen in evenings, one place or another, and I had that reservoir to fish in, and that's how the shows in the 70s were largely cast from among those people and those memories.
An expression I saw that was associated with you is, you say, he has a wet face, or she has a wet face.
I speak of people as being either, well, I suppose their faces too, either wet or dry, yeah.
Meaning
dry people are brittle and flaky. They don't hug very easily. You could cut yourself on their bones, in feeling. And wet people are warm and soft and supple, and they hug real easy and stay away from the dries.
Well, you do have a show that's going to air later on in the winter called The Powers That Be.
It's called The Powers That Be, and it stars John Forsythe. It was created by a young writing team, Marta Kaufman and David Crane. Terribly funny and satirical. It's set in Washington. John Forsythe plays a 65-year-old senator whose family would love him to run for the presidency. it's nothing he wants. But he's dealing with power-hungry people who want him to, somebody who wants to be first lady and a daughter who wants to be first daughter. And if the show works, it should be a good deal of fun.
And will you use a live audience as well?
Yes. We've already made two and made them with a live audience.
Well, I thank you very much, Norman Lear.
You're very welcome.
Television producer Norman Lear.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played
songs that made the hit parade.
like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew where you were then.
Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herman Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare states.
Everybody pulled his weight. Gee, our old LaSalle ran great. Those were the days.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the news today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. We'll be hearing today about the next round of Middle East peace talks, the war in Yugoslavia, the new UN Secretary General. And we'll also be talking with Edward Bernays on his birthday. You know who Edward Bernays is?
I do not.
Mr. Bernays is 100 years old today. He and his wife, Doris Fleischman, back in 1919, started a business in which they advised clients on how they might make their case better understood by the public and how they might improve their relations with the public. He's considered the founder of modern public relations.
Great. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some classic blues recordings of Bessie Smith are now being reissued on compact disc. Smith recorded with a lot of the great jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong, Coleman Hawkins, and Fletcher Henderson. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says one of her key partners has gotten little attention, trombonist Charlie Green. Here's Green playing with Armstrong on Nashville Woman's Blues.
Bessie Smith's blues are, of course, celebrated for her magnificent singing, but her classic recordings from the 1920s also helped jazz soloists find their voices. When she first went into the studio in 1923, jazz was still mostly a collective art, with horns weaving around each other Dixieland style. But Smith's records were spare, with just piano and maybe one or two horns. When she took a breath, a horn player would slide in to answer her last line. For a few seconds, he was out front, but he had to make a statement fast, and if he was any good, his playing took on some of the inflections and power of Bessie's voice. Louis Armstrong. The second volume in the complete Bessie Smith series takes in 1924 and 25. That was when she recorded with Armstrong, and when she first encountered a musician she liked enough to use on 21 recording dates altogether. Charlie Green, nicknamed Big Green, was practically the only trombone player she ever recorded with. Charlie Green uses a plunger mute there to get that wah-wah sound to mimic her voice. Using a rubber plunger wasn't a brand new idea, but Smith's records helped popularize the technique. It soon became a hallmark of Duke Ellington's orchestral style.
Last night I heard my man cry. Everybody says he was dying. Oh me, they cry.
Charlie Green wasn't a great virtuoso, but his horn and Bessie Smith's voice made a natural fit. Both had a bellowing middle register sound that lent itself well to primitive recording techniques and to playback on gramophones. Green's strong presence comes across even when he plays behind Louis Armstrong. Big Green was a member of Fletcher Henderson's orchestra when he recorded with Smith, but he wasn't featured much with that band. Green died prematurely in the winter of 1936, freezing to death after getting locked out of his New York apartment. He hasn't been treated well by historians either, but Bessie Smith knew his worth. She recorded a tribute to and with him in 1927. There have been a few classic partnerships in improvised music, like Billie Holiday and Lester Young, or Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. But maybe none has been as unjustly overlooked as this one.
Oh, Charlie, make it sing. That's like trombone. You leaving, make a king. Get out of his throne. And he would break a leg.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer living in New York. We've been listening to Bessie Smith, The Complete Recordings, Volume 2, on the Columbia Legacy label. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Joel Sander has written a new study of teenage mothers, focusing on four women of four different generations in one African-American family. Each became a mother when she was a teenager. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet Sander and the youngest mother in the family she studied. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.